We are in Ezra chapter 3. As we open up this chapter, we have some nearly 50,000 people who have traveled on foot, on the back of donkeys and horses, and I don't know if they had wagons back then, and some type of carts, for nearly 900 miles, making their way from Babylon to Jerusalem, and there were no bathroom stops. And that's because the dads were driving. You know, us dads, it's like, nope, you can hold it. You wait until we get there. So there they are, waiting to get there. I don't know how long it took. It took months, no doubt. They get there. Parents can finally answer the question, are we there yet? Yes, we're here. Finally, they pull into Jerusalem. Bodies are stiff because they've been in those cars for so long, and people are cranky, and siblings are fighting. And as they pull into town, there's a mixture, right? There's a mixture of excitement, but I bet you anything, there's also a mixture of disappointment. And the disappointment is due to this. They have just left the cultural center, the affluent center of the world, Babylon, and they have pulled into a rundown trailer park called Jerusalem. And that's what it was. It was a rundown trailer park. It was in ruins. It was rubble there. I mean, nothing existed. Nothing existed. So here they are. They're trying to balance out their disappointment and yet knowing that God is greater than what they see. And so as they climb out of their vehicles, as they stretch their limbs, we see that the very first substantial thing that they do as a community of faith, the very first thing they do is to build an altar to worship. The first thing they do is to worship. And you may say, well, of course they worship. That's what religious people do. And what I want you to hear in part today is that's not just what religious people do. It's what everybody does. Everybody worships. The issue isn't whether you worship. The issue is what you worship. You worship whether you are Christian or not, devout or not, an Anglican or an atheist. Everybody worships. And getting that right is the very bedrock of life. The bedrock of being a healthy individual, having a family that's healthy, being in a community that's healthy, getting that worship right. You have to get it right. I think of the novelist David Foster Wallace, whose own religious affiliation is iffy. I don't know where he stood with God. Some people read him as a Christian, other people as not. Regardless, he speaks very powerful words at a graduating class, or to a graduating class in 2005 at Kenyon College, tragically before he committed suicide. But these words are riveting. This is what he says. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type of thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before you die. Worship power and you will feel weak and afraid, and you will feel the need ever more power to have more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect and you will end up feeling stupid. A fraud, always on the verge of being found out. He says, the insidious thing about all these forms of worship is that they are really unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship that you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you are doing. And all of the world never discourages you in that, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear, contempt, frustration, craving, and the worship of self. So says David Wallace. Powerful words, aren't they? Powerful. I mean, it's simple. Everyone worships. Everyone worships. You may not know it, but you do, and it's also practical. All you have to do is look at your daily life and see what you look to for your value and your meaning and your identity, and you will see the God for that day. What are the fears that drive you tomorrow? What are the loves that motivate you? What are the joys that catapult you into action? There you will find the God or the gods that you worship. Look at what occupies your mind, your imagination, your thought life, your decision making, and there you will see what you worship. You see, worship is so practical. And your life, you will either languish as a person or you will thrive as a person dependent upon you worshiping the right person. Getting worship right is critical. And today, as we turn to Ezra chapter 3, we're going to see a couple of critical areas to get straight in order to get worship right. A couple of critical areas to get straight in order to get worship right. Right, let's look at Ezra chapter 3, verse 1. We read, "When the seventh month came, and the children of Israel were in the towns, the people gathered as one man to Jerusalem. Then arose Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, with his kinsmen. And they built the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God." I'm guessing, as we open this up, I'm guessing that they've been in town maybe a couple of months, no more than 4 months. And I'll tell you why. I mean, so I moved from California to Washington. In California, you really could never have fireworks. You could have a sparkler only on 4th of July and not on New Year's. Okay. Here, you guys go big or you go home, right? Two major holidays to stock up on pyrotechnics, and you don't miss either one of them. Here are your two opportunities. That was kind of like the altar of burnt offering. I mean, you would build it and you would light it up. I mean, that was a huge deal. Now, notice how we have the seventh month mentioned here in verse 1. That happened to be the Jewish New Year, filled with lots of holy partying, including pyrotechnics, meaning the lighting up of the temple and worshiping God in this way. So this was the month where you had the Day of Atonement, you had the Feast of Booths. This was the month where you would celebrate. Now, the prior month or the prior holiday that you could light up your fireworks would be about 4 months earlier during the Jewish Independence Day. That would be the Passover. And I'm telling you, if they would have been in town for the Passover, so 4 months earlier, this would have happened then. But it doesn't. And this indicates to me that they arrived sometime in summer, because the Passover was in spring, and that this happens in the seventh month. So now, regardless of the particular timing, this is what you need to get. They are literally starting out in life. They're just starting out. Fresh out of Babylon, brand spanking new to Jerusalem. They haven't picked out their apartments yet. They don't know where they're going to send little Johnny to school. They haven't picked out couches from Ashley Furniture to furnish their home. They haven't brushed off their resume and uploaded it to LinkedIn. They haven't looked at the field to see what are the career and employment opportunities. No, they haven't had the time to do anything like that. No, this is what they do. The very first substantial thing that they do is they leave their bags at whatever doors they may have for whatever lodgings that they may have, at least temporarily. And they leave the suburbs of Jerusalem, because that's where they're settling, and they make their way to the big city, and they build an altar together. We see as one man, they build an altar and they worship. They worship. Before they did anything for the very first time, they worship. Worship is what happens when you have something go first in your life. Worship happens with what goes first, with what comes first, what is first in your life. Worship happens when you start. That's my first point today. Whatever worship is, and yes, it may include a banjo, which was really awesome, right? And some cool tunes and lights and sound. I mean, that's a part of worship. But there's so much more, and we can't cover all of it. Whatever worship is, at the very least, we know that worship is defined as what comes first in your life. What comes first in your dreams and your thoughts and your relationships and in your affections, whatever comes first. And that's so basic if you think about it. Because whatever you value will be prioritized in your life. The lesser the value, the lower it gets on that totem pole. The more that you value something, the higher it gets on that list of priorities. The greatest thing you value, there it is at the very front end of your life. I mean, think about it. For example, here's an illustration. It's a warm summer day. You're eating a turkey sandwich on your porch. You're reading a book. And all of a sudden, your spouse, who is in the military overseas, you thought they were there, but they decided to surprise you with a visit. And there they are at the very front of the driveway with some gift in hand, with arms wide open. And there you are. You see your spouse, whom you thought was in the Middle East. You have a choice. What comes first? Do you finish your turkey sandwich first? Do you say, wait a minute, I got a book, I'm in the middle of a chapter, it's riveting. It's a book about being an awesome military spouse. Let me finish the book, and then I'll embrace. Of course not. Because of the value of the person in front of you, all of a sudden, that priority for that afternoon, just alone time, me, a turkey sandwich, the school book, all of a sudden, that's the last thing you're thinking of. The value of that person compels you to embrace. Is immediately, you know, shot up as the first in the chart of your list of priorities. It's so basic. What you value the most becomes first in your life. This is also the very principle behind why in the past, and it's not like I have an ongoing problem with this, but in the past, when I've owed the IRS money, paying them was the last thing I did. I waited to the last day on the deadline. I'm going to finish my sandwich. I'm going to read my book. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And then I'll go ahead and make good on my obligation. Why? Because, well, as you could tell, I don't worship the IRS. I don't, you know, I guess we need them, but they can be tough. When I wasn't a Christian and I was far younger than I am now, I know that it's hard to believe that I'm not young. But when I was really young, when I thought of God and I thought of Christianity, when I thought of the whole Jesus thing, it all kind of appeared to me as a bit like the IRS. You know, it's like, wow, why in the world would I do this Jesus thing first in my life? It's the last thing I wanted to do first. I knew in my own twisted mind that I owed God something, right? Just like I knew I owed, rightfully so, taxes. But my mentality was this. I'm going to wait to the very last moment of my life to do this Jesus thing, to be a Christian. You know, when I get old, that's when I'll become a Christian. Because as we know, Christianity is for old people, right? It's not for young people. It's not for a young guy just starting out in life. The whole promised land is in front of him. So many places to explore, so many things to experiment with. I mean, if I were there with Zerubbabel, I would say, dude, can we just get a house first? Can we establish, I don't know, a basic financial infrastructure in my home? Can we explore first? Can I get a girlfriend? Can I get married? Can I experiment with life? Zerubbabel, we can wait later. Why in the world would the first thing we do first be to build an altar and worship when all of these things in my life seem neglected? That was my mentality. Why would I put God first? Like Augustine, the church father who was living a promiscuous lifestyle, he kept praying to God, God, make me chaste, but not yet. And he prayed that. That was his prayer. And he had a praying mother who, you know, just made his lifestyle miserable. And he came to faith and became one of the most influential Christians of the first 1,000 years. Now, this may be what you're thinking this morning. You've told yourself, if I do become a Christian later, let me live a little. Let me experiment. Let me enjoy. Let me call the shots of my own life first. Let me be the master and the captain of my vessel first. And then maybe later on, I'll do that Jesus thing. Or perhaps you are a Christian this morning, and what you've discovered in your life is that prayer is becoming more and more an afterthought. Bible reading a chore. Christian community almost non-existent. At one time, God was first. At one time, you had that fiery first love. But as time went on, there was nothing sinister. Nothing sinister. It's just that life happened. Life gets busy. So many things to do. So many hobbies. So many places to go. So many things that can occupy your affections that gradually God became less and less a priority in your life. And what I want you to see in both of these cases, see what's happening. You're not putting the sandwich down to embrace your spouse. You're not putting the book down to embrace the person of far greater value. And how ridiculous that is, right? For a couple of reasons. The first is the most obvious. You are neglecting the far greater value of one for the far lesser value of another. I mean, that seems obvious, but how about this? Here's a second way this is ridiculous. What happens if you tell that newly return spouse with gift in hand, with arms wide open, that before you embrace them for the good of your marriage, so you're doing this for the good of the marriage, you have to finish the book on marriage. Let me ask you, does that make the marriage better or worse? Well, wait a minute, it's a marriage book, right? It's a marriage book. And of course, even a good book about marriage is no replacement to your spouse. Here's the point. Moms and dads who put their family as number one in their life do not become better parents, they become worse. Did you know you can idolize your family? You can worship family. You can worship your kids. They can absolutely determine the priorities of your life such that Christianity is now morphed and adapted and redacted in order to fit your dreams and your vision for your children. It happens all the time. And I'm telling you, I get it, man. I'm putting a lot of energy in my kids. Certainly, this will make us a better family when, in fact, it doesn't make you a better family. It makes you a worse family. A businessman or a woman who gives all of their time and attention and energy and their heart's affection to the success of their business does not become a better businessman or woman. They become a worse if that takes the place of God. If that's the thing around which now I'm starting to alter my Christianity to fit in on my entrepreneurial ambitions. You see, the best moms and dads don't put being mom and dad number one in their lives. The best pastors, the best Christians, the best employees, employers, the best siblings, you name it, just fill in the blank, they become better, not worse, when those things do not occupy number one. But instead, God occupies that place because they know therein lies the power. Therein lies the perspective. Therein lies the fuel to be all that God is calling you to be in whatever vocation, whatever relationship, whatever circumstance that you happen to find yourself in. You see, worship is critical for getting life right. Remember the words of Jesus. We quote them often. Most churches do. Jesus says this, seek second the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Does it say that? Seek last the kingdom of God and his... No, doesn't. Not in my Bible. If your Bible says that, we're going to have a book burning. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all those other things that you're tempted to get in the place of God will be resolved. Will be resolved. Worship happens where you start. That's my first point. Here's my second point. Worship happens when you fear. Worship happens when you fear. And so at the end of verse 2, we see that they build this altar to the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And now notice verse 3. They set the altar in its place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the lands. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. So they build an altar, they're setting that altar in its place, and yet we see fear, and there's fear for the peoples of the land. Who are the peoples of the land? Well, quickly, 5 decades earlier, the king of the world invades and forcibly detains and deports most of the Jewish population there in Jerusalem and Judea, all the way to Babylon, and all of a sudden there's left in that community a ghost town. Empty houses, empty Costcos, empty Taco Bells, empty neighborhoods, empty schools. But those places did not remain empty too long, because certainly the nation surrounding, the people who were a part of the region, they quickly went in and claimed that property, those stores, those houses, those schools as their own. So now, fast forward 5 decades later, the Lord gives the green light to go back. Here's the first of a couple of waves of lots of Jews showing up, and they got this letter from the king saying, you know, you better listen or else. And they have titles to their property. They're knocking on doors and they're telling the peoples of the land, so glad for you that you had free rent for 5 decades, but I want my keys back. I want my house back. I want my business. I want my cul-de-sac. How do you think the peoples of the land are going to respond to that? Right? They've been there for now 5 decades. For some of them, this is all they know. Are they going to be responsive of that? Are they going to say, yeah, welcome. Here's some leis. We'll put them around your neck. Welcome. Nope, not at all. They will resist. And that is beginning already. It'll get so bad that about 80, 100 years from now, when Nehemiah is building the wall of Jerusalem, the builders are building with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. And that animosity is taking place here. And so quite naturally, the Jews fear. This is not a militia coming. These are parents and grandparents. It's your cousins and your uncles. These aren't skilled warriors. They're very, very vulnerable, even with an edict from the king. And so they fear. Now, some of your translations may suggest that they built the altar in spite of their fear. They built the altar in spite of their fear. So what that would mean is, man, they were getting ready to build, and all of a sudden these people emerge out of the woods. They are pressuring. They are mad dogging them, giving them the evil eye. And now they're a little nervous about this altar building project. And so fear is kind of holding them back, dampening their zeal, but they push through with resolve, and they end up doing what their gut is telling them not to do because of the threat surrounding them. So that's one way to take this passage. But there's another translation, and it happens to be the translation in my Bible, which is clearly the right one. Notice what it says. They set the altar in its place for, not despite, but for fear was on them because of the peoples of the land. That has, in my mind, a very different connotation. Instead of fear distracting and dampening and squelching the desire to worship, what we see here is that fear was the fuel of worship. They make fear precisely the place where they worship. This is the place they stop and they build an altar to worship. This is the place where they stop and they say, God, we need to be struck once again, because we all forget, we need to be struck once again with how you are so much greater than our enemies. The world is against us. What does that matter if God is for us? And so the altar is their way of saying, God, when I'm afraid, help me to see that you're bigger. Help me to see that you're bigger. Now, what translation is the best? Actually, I don't know. I didn't do that research. But it seems to me that both translations tell us two ways we all tend to respond to fear and anxiety. And there are these ways. We either let our fears make us less aware of God or more aware of God. We will either allow our fears and our uncertainties and our anxieties to drive us to the altar or from the altar. Now listen very carefully. What I'm not saying and would never suggest is that the difference between really worshiping God and not worshiping God is, well, you don't fear over here and you're scared over here. And if you're scared, you're not really worshiping God. That is not the message. Because it turns out, fear is something that God gives. God has hardwired you when you find yourself in environments that are threatening. I mean, your body is designed immediately to pump adrenaline, for your brain to be hyperactive, for your senses to be super acute, so that you might navigate those threats with your family, whoever that is, to safety. That's all a gift from God. The issue between worshiping and not worshiping isn't the issue of do you fear or not fear. No, the issue of worship is this. When you face real threats in life, to your health, to your relationships, whatever that may be, does that fear drive you to God or from God? And so fear becomes an issue of worship when it drives you from God. That is, when you allow the people in your life, the problems, the circumstances, to become the thing in the universe in your mind that has ultimate power and control over you, that's false worship. It's when you allow other people's rejection of you to be greater than God's acceptance of you. It's when you allow your perception of your lack to be far greater than God's supply. It's when you allow those people with those evil plans in your mind to be greater than God's sovereign plan over your life. It's when you attribute to things in the world a power that only belongs to God. That's a worship matter. Looking at something as greater than God. And I've asked this of you before, and I'll keep asking it throughout my ministry because I think it's one of those important questions to ask yourself frequently, and it's this. What's that one thing in your life today, if it were taken away, would absolutely ruin you? What's that one thing in your life, if taken from you today, even God himself would not be enough for you? Whatever that answer is, that's the thing that you esteem as greater than God. There is false worship. And so fear becomes a matter of worship when it drives you from God. Another way of saying this is fear becomes a matter of worship when it drives you to other things, right? That's just the flip side of it. You know, so when you're stressed, when you're freaking out, when you're in the pressure cooker, where do you go? How do you cope? Who do you look to? How do you manage? How do you process the anxiety, the fear? What do you do? What do you do? Who do you look to, you might say, to save you from that, from those things, from those people? And we all know, because, hey, if you've been in this world for a few years, you know that human nature has the tendency of bypassing the real altar and constructing false altars by which and on which we deal with our fears, right? So many alternative altars, so many different places that we go to cope. There's the altar of alcohol, prescription medication, pornography, the altar of isolation, self-justification, self-righteousness. There's the altar of codependency, and we can go on and on and on, and so many of you, or some of you at least, you have learned the hard way that those altars do not make things better. They don't save. They're horrible gods. They make things worse than better. You've learned the hard way. The Lord wants you to learn the easy way, not the hard way. I've told this before. I'll tell it again because it's that good. It's a story about a pastor visiting an elderly congregant. He shows up to the house, sits down. He didn't eat breakfast, so he's famished. He notices a big bowl of peanuts there on the coffee table, and he says, "Do you mind if I have some?" And she says, "Go ahead, enjoy." And so they spend about an hour in conversation, and at the end, he realizes he has to get up, he has to go, and as he does so, he looks down, and he realizes he ate the entire bowl of peanuts. I mean, it's huge. And so he's apologizing to the lady. "I'm so sorry. I was so famished, but boy, they were delicious." And she said, "Don't worry about that, hon. You know, ever since I lost my teeth, all I can do is to suck the chocolate off of them anyways." He never had peanuts again. He learned the hard way. You don't have to learn the hard way. You can learn the easy way. Let's talk about the easier way. Oh, it's a narrow path, but the broad path leads to destruction. The narrow path leads to life. And that leads me to my third point. Worship happens when you start. Worship happens when you fear. Thirdly, worship happens when you submit. So notice again at the end of verse 2, they build the altar, they offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written. Notice the terminology of obedience, of subjection to the law of Moses or the law of God. Verse 3, and they set the altar in its place, for fear was on them because of the peoples of the land, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening, and they kept the Feast of Booths as it is written. Notice, again, the terminology of obedience, of submission. And offer daily burnt offerings by number according to the rule. See the submission there. They're submitting to God as each day required. There's obedience. And after that, the regular burnt offerings and the offerings at the new moon and all the appointed feasts in the law, they're submitting of the Lord, and the offerings of everyone who made a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. Do you see how, as they began this new life, they allow God to set the terms, the parameters, the rules? And this isn't just for one ritual. It's God teach us about life. Help us to submit to what you say about life. And then there's, again, verse 3. They set the altar in its place. So just think about that. They built it and set it in its place. Some commentators say this. They say when you compare this verse with chapter 4, verse 2, Jeremiah 41, verse 5, I think, and a handful of other pictures or passages, the picture that we have in front of us is that when the Jews were vacant from the land for 5 decades, the pagan peoples of the land, they swooped in and decided to create their own alternative altar. And so now, in order to build afresh, in order to really begin well, they have to dismantle. They have to demolish. And this is a part of the reason why they are fearing. They are touching on a sacred cow in that culture. And they are dismantling, displacing, so that they can get the right altar in place. Now, it seems to me that obedience to God, whatever that means, and we'll talk more about what that means, submission to his will is really a kind of demolishing in our lives. Right? How many of you submit to what you really are enthusiastic about? Like, I submit to the 60 mile per hour speed law. I'm not enthusiastic about it, folks. So I submit to it. We don't obey things that we are fully engaged in our affections. No, obedience and submission presumes there's something in us that says, man, if I had my druthers, I would do different. I would have it different, but I'm going to yield the autonomy of my will. I'm going to bow the knee. I'm going to allow for there to be a kind of dismantling, a demolishing, a removal of the things that I want, the agenda that I have, the values that I possess, in order to have someone else in its place, in their place, put something different. That's kind of like obedience. There is a dismantling, there is a demolition that takes place. A demolition from God, not to leave you barren, but to build you up. Now, let me be very cautious here. Listen carefully. And I say listen carefully because some of us, we've been raised in churches, and I don't think they meant it. They didn't mean it. But the message you heard in the presentation they made of Christianity was this: if you obey, then you're accepted. First obey, first submit, dig deep, try harder, fall in line, become a good boy, become a good girl, and then maybe then you will be counted as someone who can approach the temple, someone who can have a relationship with God. Let me tell you, that is anti-gospel. That is the exact antithesis of what Jesus came to do and to accomplish in your life. We call that legalism. People stray from God in two ways, either in license, doing whatever they want, or by thinking if they follow the rules, God owes them. Both are egregious errors from the gospel. So here's what you need to know. You need to know the bigger picture in which obedience happens, and it's found at that brazen altar, that bronze altar that they are building. It points to the bigger picture. Notice how they don't build the temple first, they build the altar first. That's on purpose, because you can never approach the temple and commune with God without doing business with God at the altar. That's where God would have a come to Jesus talk with you. And so you would come to the altar, and two things would happen at that altar. Number one, atonement, and number two, alteration. Atonement first, and only after that, change in your life. So let's talk about the atonement piece. So first of all, as you approach this bronze altar, this massive altar, when you went there, you would experience the ultimate death blow, demolition to any little bit of ego that you had. If you were looking for a pep talk, if you wanted a motivational speech saying, oh boy, you're full of potential. Oh, you're so full of virtue. You're so lovable. And when people think you're wrong, that's on them, not you. Oh, you are the best next thing to sliced bread. If that's the talk that you want, don't go to the brazen altar. Because as you approached, there your sin, all of your sin, was exposed and revealed for what it was, deserving of death. All of the false altars that you worshiped at, revealed. All of the things that you've allowed in the place of God, revealed. This was not the place to receive a pep talk. This was a place where your self-righteousness was broken down. You couldn't barter with God after that, saying, God, I lived a good life. Bless me now and bless me with eternity. It would not happen. Now, certainly, the Jews gathered at this altar. If they learned anything from their past, they're not beating their chest saying, we're so much better than our ancestors. No. The reason why they're so eager to build this brazen altar is because if you were sinless, you didn't need it. But if you were sinful, oh, how you needed it. It was for people who realize that they are completely incapable of saving and changing themselves. And so the first thing that happens at the altar is atonement. And the first part of that atonement is demolition, but it doesn't stop there. In the gospel, God does not stop with dismantling you, with demolishing you. The demolition is followed by renovation. And this altar, this bronze altar, is a picture of God's amazing, extravagant, wonderful, loving intention to build you up gloriously. It's not just about tearing you down. It's tearing you down as that little outhouse to build you up as a palace in which he dwells. And so this is how the altar symbolizes this. God says, hey, as you approach this altar, bring with you a substitute. A sacrifice, an animal. I don't want you to die for your own sins, and so someone else will die in your place. Death is the ultimate demolition, right? Bring a substitute in your place, and all of your guilt will be accounted to that animal, and he will die, and all of its innocence accounted to you symbolically, and you will live. And of course, the animal didn't save the worshiper. That was all a pre-enactment of what God would do for us in the gospel. It was a foreshadowing of Jesus. You see, in the Bible describes Jesus not just as the ultimate substitute and sacrifice. He is. He is. On the cross, all of your sin placed on him. He bears the punishment that you deserve, though he is innocent. And as you place faith in him, all of his perfect righteousness, his obedience, his love of God is accounted to you, even though practically you sin and you fail. That happens when you believe in Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate substitute, but not just the ultimate substitute. In places like Hebrews 13:10, he is the ultimate altar. The Bible says that when God gave the plans for the temple, he designed that brazen altar to be a pointer to Jesus, whose life would go up before God as a soothing aroma, because of which we can draw near to the throne of grace for acceptance and forgiveness. It's atonement first. And it's in this that obedience is rooted. Consider what the Apostle Paul tells the Romans in Romans 16. He says, let me tell you what I'm called to as I preach the gospel. I'm called to call the Gentiles and all people to the obedience of faith. Not just raw, rugged, you know, step up, comply, obey. Not just obedience, but notice it's the obedience of faith. Faith is obedience. Faith is you coming clean with who you are and what you've done. Faith is coming to Jesus with who you are, coming clean with him, and from there being cleansed by him. And out of that comes the obedience. You are first atoned for, and then with the atonement, then there is alteration. You come to the altar of Jesus to be atoned for and to be altered, to be changed. I mean, that was the point of our series in the fall, in Romans chapter 12. Remember how that chapter begins? In light of the mercies of God, in light of what Jesus is, he is the ultimate sacrifice because of which we have right standing with God, with hearts exploding with joy and gratitude because of what Jesus did. You respond in worship by throwing your life in consecration on the altar as a burnt offering. It's a response. God, look at what you did. I'm giving myself to you freshly. And then God does the work of transforming your life. It's interesting that Paul ends that section saying, this is worship. This is what worship is all about. Worship happens when you start. It happens when you fear. It happens when you submit. We're going to worship right now. The team's going to come up. And what I want to challenge you to do is to come to the altar. And I don't mean the platform. I mean, you're welcome to do that. But I just said, Hebrews 13:10 makes it clear, Jesus is the altar. And to come to him, maybe for the very first time. It is likely that there's someone here who is not a believer and you're feeling the tug of the Holy Spirit. God is calling you to not try to approach him apart from Jesus. God is calling you to himself to experience the lavish love and forgiveness and the transformation of Jesus, to be changed, to be revolutionized. Come this morning, talk to Jesus. Say to him in your mind, Jesus, come into my life. Make me new. Forgive me of my sins. Alter me. And if you really mean that, and that comes from your very heart of hearts, even if it's slightly genuine, I believe, because my faith, I was slightly genuine when I came to faith. The Lord seized that, rushed into my life, and began the work of renovation. Or maybe you're here and you don't have that first love. God has slipped out of that first spot in your life. That's got to change today. I mean, doesn't it? He's the greatest being ever. It's in him that you have your greatest joy. Don't leave here this morning without having your heart reoriented to the firstness of God in your life. Come to him. Hey, we have our hang-ups, we have our habits, we have our addictions, we have our challenges. Come to him. Come to him again. I mean, that's what we see in this chapter. They keep coming to him. They establish a calendar of consecration weekly, monthly, annually. They keep coming over and over again. God is not tired or weary with you coming to him again. No, he invites you. He delights in you coming to him again, saying, Lord, I need you. Forgive me. Change me. Alter me. And he'll meet you.